Welcome. Good to see you. Come.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 381 for the week of November 15th, 2021. I am buried bovine David T. Cole, and I'm here with unwanted curtain lining Sarah D. Bunting.
I want to speak to Jerome.
Surprise candle Tara Ariano.
You told them it wasn't fireproof, right?
And art collector David J. Roth.
Oh, fuck you, Andy Warhol.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us, he's an editor at Defector.com, a co-host on the podcasts The Distraction and It's Christmas Town. You've also heard him here. It's David J. Roth.
David, welcome
David.
Back.
Wow.
David! Yeah.
I love that guy. Yay. Oh, wow.
I was consciously trying to drown out the screaming guy this time because it just put me on my heels every single time I've been on here.
Yep.
Can't be done.
Possible.
We are here to talk about The Shrink Next Door, in which Marty Markowitz, Will Ferrell, has just taken over running his family's fabric company after the death of his father. But since he is settling uneasily into leadership, experiencing panic attacks at the slightest pushback from clients, his sister Phyllis, Catherine Hahn, urges him to see a therapist who was recommended by their rabbi. Marty resists, but Dr. Ike Hirschkopf, Paul Rudd, makes him feel at ease and feels just terrible when their very casual session stretches past the allotted hour. He refuses to let Marty pay him for two sessions for a while, but then gives in, and gives in a lot more easily when he causes Marty to go over the hour again while their work continues. As Marty grows more dependent on Dr. Ike, Phyllis gets concerned about the ethical boundaries Dr. Ike is trampling. It's a true crime story adapted from Wondery and Bloomberg's true crime podcast of the same name. It was adapted by Georgia Pritchett, whose past credits include Run and Succession. She wrote both season two's Safe Room and next week's Too Much Birthday. The first three episodes of The Shrink Next Door have dropped. We got screeners for the first season, so some of us may have watched ahead and or know more about the true story that inspired it because they run a true crime newsletter, for example. And it's on Apple TV+. Let's do the Chen check-in. Dave Roth, should our listeners watch The Shrink Next Door?
This is going to be a low energy answer. I would say, you know, if you're intrigued by the idea of like Paul Rudd wearing a bunch of 80s sweaters and Will Ferrell having like even curlier hair than usual, then maybe. It personally didn't really move the needle for me very much, and I'm still trying to figure out why I didn't dig it more.
Okay.
But it might be that the back half is good. It felt a little distended and a little flat for me.
Sarah D. Bunting.
I think if you didn't listen to the podcast, you could try it. I'm all set after 2.5, and I'll talk about that more. But sure, and a question mark?
I will probably pick it up unless it falls way off. But yeah, I agree with like, maybe. Dave, right. Dave, what do you think?
No, I agree with Dave said. I feel like it needed a little more pep in its step, but also I am sort of interested in how it actually plays out. There's a lot of weird little things that I enjoy, also enjoy making fun of about this show. So we can get into
Let's get into the discussion then. Starting with Dave R. Should second bar mitzvah be the hot new trend for 40th birthday parties, in your opinion?
I feel like there's a lot of people that have a lot riding on that. Like, I don't know what else Ja Rule's business model is for the next few years, but I feel like this is... there's a lot of money in that particular banana stand if they can do it. I will say that the second bar mitzvah bit, which was kind of the big showpiece from the first third, like there's a lot of stuff in this that, and I know you didn't ask me on this. I'm sure you know other Jewish people. You know, your people, worldly
who live
individuals.
In New York? Yes, I do.
Who live, yeah, right, and have also been in therapy for decades. Like it's not. I know that's kind of baked into the other stuff I was talking about. You don't need me to tell you that a little bit of the Jewish stuff in this is kind of like heavy-handed and made me feel kind of weird.
Okay.
The second bar mitzvah bit was one of those things where if they'd played it more overtly as funny, I think I would have liked it more. In all of this, I just kind of wish that they went for jokes if they were going to go for jokes. I didn't know the original podcast, but they seemed kind of reverent of it.
Mm.
So I assume there was a real, like, in real life second bar mitzvah for Marty Markowitz or whatever the guy's real name was. But yeah, the one that was on screen didn't, I don't know. I guess I probably would have more fun at my bar mitzvah if I was able to drink, but that's otherwise I can't in good conscience recommend it.
Sarah, it sounded like you had listened to the podcast. What was your read on that and on the tone overall?
I listened to the podcast and I have no, like, I remember listening to it and mm-hmm. I remember not disliking it, but I remember not adoring it. Like, mm-hmm. there's something about Wondery product that is like, it seems filling and then it does its job. But it's also like, it's quite predictable sort of like tonally, and there's a certain turgidity, and like the pacing of it is very, like there's a house style of speed.
Right.
To a Wondery podcast, and I felt like this, as with a lot of, not even adaptations of podcasts, but a lot of true crime, like prestige-y docudrama, that it's just like, we got 8 episodes and we're going to use every minute. And it's like, can't things just be 4 or 5? Like, right. This felt awfully, with good reason, in love with its own production design, in love with its own accent coaching, less reason for smugness there. But yeah, like compared with the podcast, I just felt like there are a lot of things here that are overdetermined, and self-regarding in a way that works against like the interest level. But at the same time, like from a production design standpoint, it is sort of very watchable. And, you know, remembering that era and having grown up in the area, that was somewhat compelling. But once you realize where the story is going, it's like, I sort of walked away from it in the middle of the 3rd episode because I was like, I'm not so interested in how they get there mm-hmm. that I want to spend another 5 episodes.
Right.
I mean, Wondery product is like just very sort of glossily predictable. It's sort of the why people go to Starbucks in Paris principle, that it's like, maybe right. it's not the best, but it's good enough. And it, you know what it is.
Yeah. I mean, I thought about that episode, which is the second one, that Phyllis is real hurt about Marty sort of trying to negate the actual day that they had as a family is one of the more understatedly true and great moments in Catherine Hahn's performance, which I feel like mm-hmm. as written by, played by someone else, it could have been very cartoony, but I thought she was one of the highlights, as she is one of the highlights of most things mm-hmm. she does. I thought Catherine Hahn was great. Sarah, true crime is your lane, as we've already covered. Did you think these first episodes took too long to get to the crime? Was that maybe one of the problems that you had?
I think from the standpoint of like marketing this thing that, you know, either people are watching this because they listen to the podcast, so they already know and you can take your time, or they skipped the podcast and now they want the story, so maybe you should speed it up more. Like, I don't, because I did watch the podcast and this is my lane, I don't have the patience to keep going with it. But I do think generally that there are some directorial and pacing choices that are just, like I said, a little too self-regarding and painstaking.
I feel like I would be happy to watch the conclusion of the story on Apple TV, but equally happy for Sarah just to tell me how it plays out now.
Yeah.
Part of it is that you got Will Ferrell and Paul Rudd in the same room together, and it really feels like they're not really working them the way they should be. Like, I don't know exactly what Paul Rudd's doing in this show, but it's off enough that all I can see is the line in his beard. Like, all I'm looking at when he's on his screen is the shave line on his very dark beard for a 55-year-old, mm-hmm. whatever he is now, mm-hmm. 52. It either needed to be playing a little darker and playing against, you know, against type, or embracing that you have two people on top of their comedy game and doing things with a lighter touch. And again, I don't know what this crime is at the end of the story. Maybe it's super visceral and I'm just totally not wanting something that's going to match with the end game here.
Yeah.
But 3 episodes in, I feel like I'm interested in where it's going, but they either need to get on a faster train or just like do a little more dancing while they get there, because it just feels a little flat for everybody that's involved.
Dave, that's a version of what you said. Do you agree about Red?
Yeah, I do. I mean, that's the thing that when I watched it with my wife, and the thing that we kept talking about when we were like breaking down the episodes after, we're like, all the scenes that could have been funnier had they gone for comedy in them. And again, I, to Dave's point that like, or David, we never really did hash out what we're going to be calling each other here on this episode of the
Host
podcast.
Dave and guest Dave.
Okay. You can just call me Jeff. But the there's a sense in that where like there's a bit where when Farrell is Marty is preparing for his second bar mitzvah and he's in there with the other B'nai Mitzvah for the day who is a 13-year-old girl, as would be the case. There's like a nice little sort of bit between them where he's like, well, how you doing? Are you worried about your thing? But like there's... It's Will Ferrell and a child. Like, we know that this works. It's worked in dozens of movies. Like, the guy was funny yelling at dogs on Saturday Night Live. Like, he doesn't really need anyone else in the scene. And they just keep passing on those opportunities. And yeah. If it's, you know, to Dave's point, like, if it turns out that Paul Rudd, like, murders his family or something, then, like, yeah, maybe you don't do shtick for the first 4 hours of it. But seeing the running times of the episodes sort of ticking up. It's like the first one's 36,
yeah.
The next one's 45, the next one's 51. You can kind of feel like, I don't know, like I feel like this could have been a movie, like mm-hmm. an hour and 45 minute movie yeah. if it's going in the direction that it's going. And I know that's not the incentive anymore and that's not where any of this stuff ever goes.
Right.
But yeah. It's weird to feel the length in something that is bit by bit totally a digestible size.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like if they're going to take this long to do it, they should try to have a little more fun, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about Wondery products, like I know that Cole was joking, not Jeff, Dave, was joking about, you know, why doesn't Sarah just tell us how, like what the crime is at the end? Like, this is the thing about Wondery product. As they say on Bake Off, like if you put too much icing, it just overwhelms the whole thing. Like Wondery product is very professionally packaged and then you don't necessarily remember details. Like I watched all of the Dr. Death thing for a lot of reasons, but mostly because I was like, oh yeah, oh yeah. But yeah. A lot of Wondery podcasts, like you get to, you know, episode 7 and you're like, what? Like, oh, shocking. And then it's done and it slides off your head.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't actually remember, but I'm still not motivated to. Like, I'll just Google it, and that's a problem. If I'm, like, second right. screen, this is never a good thing in a true crime property, is for me to be on Wikipedia, like, oh, word? Okay, I can quit this now. So,
right.
Yeah. It feels like they had a crime story, and then at some point they decided with the casting of Will Ferrell and Paul Rudd that they can make it a little more accessible by making it funnier. And then somebody came along and said, let's Woody Allenify this by 35%. And then that sort of like just dulls everything because everybody seems to be like doing something they saw in a Woody Allen film for, you know what I mean? Like the setting and everything sort of lends itself to it, but it really felt on point.
Yeah.
The Woody Allen call is right on to me, not just because Will Ferrell's doing kind of like if Woody Allen were like a 6'3" Nordic man, which is basically it's a nice thought
from
exercise. It's a confusing thing to encounter visually, but it's nice to think about.
Yeah, I was thinking Jesse Peretz, who directed Our Idiot Brother, because it had that similar style to me. And I thought, oh, he probably did it, but he's not involved with this at all, which is extra weird because he's worked with Paul Rudd a ton. But let's talk about something that couldn't be on the podcast, which is the aesthetics, which we talked about a little bit before we get into it. When Dr. Ike opens his door in his first episode in that Argyle vest,
and
you can see when you look at it, you know it's that like stiff kind of knitwear of the time. It was like, okay, someone put a lot of thought and effort into this. And then in the next episode, Phyllis is like head to toe Land's End, like remember looking through those catalogs when I would be babysitting in the 1980s. Like they thought about it. That and, you know, her ex's lawyer is some guy he met at racquetball. It's like full the 80s man up in this piece.
Oh my God.
What were people's favorite style moments from the 1982 parts? Dave, guest Dave, please start us off.
I mean, I don't want to step on the, I mean, you made the point. Like, I just kept thinking about how itchy all the clothes that Paul Rudd was wearing looked.
Yeah.
Like, just, I remembered it from, you know, my own youth in that period. Like, there'd be little, like, weird white tendrils coming off of it for reasons that are unexplained by any dry cleaning science known to man. It's just not a good thing to wear. The aesthetics of it. In general, like there's some pretty wild hair stuff happening in this. Like Paul Rudd definitely has the like just like a man's head of hair to which a hairdryer has been applied, like not just liberally, but vigorously. Like mm-hmm. it's really, it's all there on the screen.
Yeah.
But again, like there's this sense in which like the aesthetics feel like they're kind of standing in for a joke.
Yeah.
And to me, that is also yeah. like that extends to some of kind of the cloying Jewish shtick in it, too. And I don't know. I would have rather seen the people get to be funny as opposed to like look and sound funny and hope that that somehow would carry the day.
Mm-hmm.
That said, the sweaters were hideous. Hats off.
Yeah, I was impressed by that. I mean, they tried to do a little bit in the waiting room with Will Ferrell just like being assailed by the plants.
Yeah.
It's always striking to me, even when you see documentaries from this time, of how long it took certain people to like get with the disco aesthetic after it was already on its way out, and then how long it then persisted. So you do have that like vaguely metallic, like giant plants. I think there was a macrame hanging of some sort on the wall that it was like, you know, at my best friend Sharon's house, this is what happened. They sort of didn't figure out that they didn't get the 76 look until 1981. And then it was there until like the Bush presidency. So yeah. That made me smile. Like someone definitely took time with how things and people looked and tried not to make it look too wedding singer, which I appreciated. Like they toned down some of it and got original stuff and didn't remake it. But
right. Well, in a way, 1982 is like kind of still the 70s. Like it doesn't, the 80s doesn't really become the 80s until like after 84 or so.
Yeah, something like that. But I mean, Roth is dead on that there are certain moments where you can tell based on the shot comp that like you're like, that's the joke is the look of it. And it's like, okay, like we've all seen or know what Stranger Things looks like. Like, why are we, why do we have to do this? But I mean, they do some things well, actually. I mean, Catherine Hahn is a joy. I appreciated that they didn't over-direct the panic attacks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like these are never sort of enjoyable to watch, but there's also no way to replicate them realistically, she said with authority. So it's like, just, you know, we get it. Don't, like he's chewing on fabric. We get it. It doesn't have to be a whole thing where you're twisting the camera like it's a, you know, Van Damme movie. So
speaking about things you look at and then cannot unsee, Tara pointed out that the light and everything to do with this, obviously shot in California, set in New York, you do not get that sort of light in New York. And as soon as you said it, it's all I could see in every outdoor scene.
Yep.
And it bugged the hell out of me, especially since they're like just filming on like the old parts of Alameda, you know, Los Angeles or whatever. So,
especially like 1982 New York, like there's no way to describe how brown everything was.
The air was visible.
Yeah.
Like grains of air.
The city was almost renamed Patina back in the 80s.
Yes, it was. Or Grimina. Yep,
yeah.
For sure.
That is, I hadn't noticed that it was like in that like magic honeyed California light, but I do remember thinking, I was like, these cars all look way cleaner than I remember anything looking.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's what it is. You're not getting the particulate that would otherwise complicate the shot.
They tried to color grade it as best as they could to hide it, but still it doesn't. It's like the shadows are all wrong. It's like never overcast wherever they're shooting. Like,
mm-hmm. it's just. Warriors live. Okay, guys.
But they're supposed to be like on Second Avenue or something. And like, you can tell there's not enough darkness from the, from the high rises, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I was glad to be proven right about that. But anyway, it feels like we've said everything we need to say about this. I was happy to see our old haunt, Lincoln Square, when it was only a fourplex, which it never was when we lived there. But yeah. Taking your small children, niece and nephew, to see Tootsie when E.T. is playing right there was also a very funny character. No, but yeah.
Also, one, can I just have one shout out too for the name Marty Markowitz? Maybe it's the name of the real guy. I'd have to ask Sarah for that. It was the name of the Brooklyn Borough president when
I
lived there years ago.
Sure was.
And so I don't think I've met, like, I mean, he's a stranger to me, but I've also met him a dozen times. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just like what happens when you live there. Like, every time I would go to play softball, he would be going in there because it was like Azerbaijani Day parade in the Prospect Park.
Yeah. Sure.
Rotunda, uh-huh. And he'd be wearing traditional garb and be like, how you doing? Have fun out there today. Like, don't hit a softball too far. Just kidding. You can hit as far as you want, kid. Like, just a real goofy elfin man. So, yeah, respect to the actual Marty Markowitz.
It is time to go around the dial talking about something we've been watching recently on TV, not necessarily recent TV. First up, Tara Ariano.
Hello. First, a quick PS to my comments from last week about Frayed. I wrote about season 2 of that show for Decider. We will link that in the show notes. And thanks to everyone on our Instagram also who let us know they were checking it out because I talked about it last week. It's a good show. It deserves you putting eyes on it. So if you have some time off, especially with the holiday coming up, watch Frayed. It's really good. But my actual first highbrow pick is Yellow Jackets. This is the new, not to be confused with Yellowstone.
Oh.
They're not in the same universe, okay. Not related.
No.
This is a new drama on Showtime. It's co-created by Ashley Lyle and Bart Nickerson, who formerly worked together on both Narcos and Narcos Mexico on Netflix, and also on Dispatches from Elsewhere, which we talked about a million years ago. Like Cruel Summer, it is set in my heyday of the 1990s, although that one jumped timelines just a year apart, three timelines. This one just cuts between 1996 and 2021. Although some of the music cues were more early 90s to me for a show about high school students of 1996, there was also some sassy prop work that would have looked fine to the untrained eye, not mine. But in 1996, a high school in New Jersey, Dave and Sarah, has a so-so baseball team, boys baseball team, and an absolutely incredible girls soccer team. And the girls are on their way to nationals, and they get into typical girl business, fooling around with guys, each other's boyfriends, targeting weaker girls to try to either toughen them up or get them to quit the team. A plan is hashed regarding the one freshman girl on the team. That goes awry, but then they all get on the private plane that one rich team member's dad chartered to take them to Seattle. And by the way, host Dave, one girl gives Valium to another who's scared to fly, and she swallows it dry like a lady tough guy.
I just want a scene where somebody tries to dry swallow a pill and just like, and just has to like spend the next panic 30 seconds trying to find liquid somewhere around them to finish the transaction, because that's what happened with me.
This is a trope that has recently started really bugging Dave. That's why I brought it up. Anyway, no problem with the pill, but things go even more awry because the plane crashes. And through the episode, we get flashes forward to some very bad folk horror-ish stuff happening in some snowy woods. And though one masked and fur-wearing attacker is wearing hot pink Chuck Taylors, we could also be, you know, pretty sure these people are American girls. And by the end of the episode, it's confirmed they have turned a corner into some real weird culty shit way past Lord of the Flies. So if you think this is just the same as The Wilds on Amazon, which I talked about when it came out last year, it's not. And in the present day, the survivors of the plane crash apparently all agreed never to tell anyone exactly what happened when they were in the woods. But now one of them is trading on the story while she runs for office, and someone who may or may not be a reporter is sniffing around. So the girls are mostly unknowns other than Ella Purnell from Sweet Bitter and Murder on the Orient Express and Jasmine Savoy Brown from the Texas seasons of The Leftovers. But the grown-up survivors include Tawny Cypress, Christina Ricci, Juliette Lewis, and the great Melanie Lynskey. And I am super intrigued about how they get from a regular bunch of varsity athletes to wintertime Wicker Man shit. So I am really in this one, and it airs on Showtime Sunday nights.
Huh.
This weekend, we also watched SNL. Vanity Fair needed a sub for their regular recapper. The host was Jonathan Majors, musical guest Taylor Swift. I watched it for the first time in years to do this assignment. It confirmed to me, here's a real hot take, SNL's fucking awful. The topical cold open sketch, which Dave was in the room with me for, it was, I'm going to say, nearly unwatchable. It was so bad. It was like a Ted Cruz's Sesame Street on Newsmax for kids thing about his, like, Big Bird getting the vaccine bullshit last week.
It's kind of shit I would do first draft high school, honestly. Like,
yes.
You know, when you have to do that quick AV club presentation or whatever, and yes. It's like, well, what's in the news today? Like, here we go.
Why does the opening thing always have to be about, like, something that happened earlier that day? Like, could they just, like, put a funny bit up there? Is that used to be the case, right?
Yes.
Like, am I misremembering that?
You think you want to open strong. with your strongest material to keep people. Because, you know, if I didn't have to stick around because it was my house and I had nowhere else to go, I would have stopped watching after that one.
There were many, every time it came to a commercial, I was like, I can watch this in the other room. Like, I really felt bad. But I think the reason they went with topical for the cold open is that, like, they never stopped chasing the high of
Sarah Palin.
Tina Fey as Sarah Palin. Mm-hmm. That was, like, where things really, they had to start getting, like, we need people to blog this as, you know, SNL destroys Ted Cruz with this or that.
But also the stakes are so much different now, right? I mean, okay, well, okay, it's a continuation of the stakes that started way back when. Mm-hmm. But these days, like, everything to do with politics and the Republicans and just, like, everything about the race to the bottom is just, like, inherently kind of not funny anymore because, like, we're really looking down the barrel of something, right?
Well, and it's just like plays like gags from 2 years ago to me. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like the sort of thing that I would, like, in a dark moment be like, Ted Cruz is going to try to cancel, like, Sesame Street or some shit. And it'll be like 1:17 a.m. on a Tuesday night when I should be in bed. Mm-hmm. And, like, yeah, of course it fucking happens. You know, like, that's the world we live in. It just doesn't, it still doesn't translate to a joke. Right. Like, it's ridiculous, but you have to make it funny in order for it to sort of transcend that.
Yes. I mean, to, and, you know, as, of course, if you're doing a Sesame Street bit, you have to have Marjorie Taylor Greene come out and be like, and it's brought to you by the letter Q. Like, no. Mm. There were a couple of snort-worthy jokes, mostly in material that was clearly made not to be topical and or was pre-taped, which really makes the Weekend Update commentary by new feature player Sarah Sherman all the more salient, which her first question is, why is it live? Because why is it? Also, why is it so long? But, I do hope this season makes a superstar of James Austin Johnson because he has one of the best Trump impressions in the business. Otherwise, the show can resume being a successful institution without me. But you can read my recap, which I really strain to be positive about any of it, at vanityfair.com. We will link that in the show notes. But for my other plug, this is our last chance to plug it on Extra Hot Great this month. The Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show is trying to reach its first stretch goal of $1,000 in pledges. In order to encourage listeners to put them over, they are offering a special perk on top of all of the regular perks, ad-free episodes, empty studio play-along games, which is the Game Show Decathlon. And this is a live multi-game tournament played over Zoom with other Patreon supporters, already a perk that happens once a month. But if they reach that stretch goal by December 3rd, there will be three extra Game Show Decathlons in that Logie week between Christmas and New Year's. I play them. Many other guests of this podcast are regulars. It's a good nerdy time. So if you enjoy game time on this podcast, you'll probably also enjoy the Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show. And they are so close to hitting that goal. So help us make a lot of people's holiday wishes come true. Go to usaquizshow.com/membership and join that Patreon. Dave, anything to add?
I will be running one of them, and I'm thinking of running one that's all creative exercises. So it's actually not trivia. It's actually just like you have to convince somebody that something is real, or convince somebody that somebody would win a fight, or convince somebody they had the best. And the other two will be by Dan and Taylor. So, you know, look forward to Taylor on his keyboard doing musical stuff. Look forward to Dan doing whatever crazy Professor Dan stuff he's got going that week, that day. So, it's super fun. I enjoy playing and I enjoy running them.
And it's so close. If 10 listeners of this podcast join for $5 a month, they will get there.
Yeah,
so
we're getting close. Yeah.
Yeah. So do it. You know, only 9 people get to play the actual game every month, but everyone gets to play Game Show Decathlon. So do it.
I'm glad to hear about the mental exercise part of it, because that's the most, as somebody who's been on the show and enjoyed it and can, you know, second all of the nice things Tara just said about it, that is routinely the most mind-bending and challenging part of the whole thing. Like having to, like, defend your champion and make the case for them at the beginning of it.
Yeah.
I had, this will give something away for later in the episode. I picked Dud from Lodge 49 as my champion, not knowing what I was going to have to advocate for him to do. And it's like, it's really hard to advocate for him being your best choice at any task. And it was as hard as I've ever had to work on a podcast.
Again, this is not this is not live yet, but we just recently had somebody who picked the inanimate rod from The Simpsons, and the challenge ended up being who would perform best at the Russian ballet. And I'm not going to spoil it, but there was an argument that really made a lot of sense.
Wow. All right.
We'll see where that one goes.
Gentlemen, to Weevil.
Dave, what do you got?
Thank you for that. It is indeed. So we're behind on our TV stuff. You know, we watched a bunch of shows that you all have already talked about, and, you know, we've enjoyed hearing you talk about them. But we have never in our household been like right on time watching shows every week or when they drop or whatever. I guess we were more or less there with only Murders in the Building.
Uh-huh.
Which mm-hmm. I dug very much, but, you know, is kind of old news at this point. So I picked something that's even older news because we finally finished watching the most recent season of Evil by Robert and Michelle King, which I believe is on Paramount Plus now. And not, it used to have a different name. We are a King's household. Mm-hmm. I think they're great. I am also kind of like wondering where they are in their broader trajectory now, because I feel like they've sort of, like, I'm enjoying the King's wilderness period. I think there was a peak for them with mm-hmm. like the very end of not the very, very end of The Good Wife, but like the last seasons of The Good Wife, first season of The Good Fight. I loved Brain Dead, which is like a one season summer thing that I think is like, has my favorite Tony Shalhoub performance ever in it. And I'm a big Shalhoub boy. But the this one, and especially I think the recent seasons of The Good Wife, not exactly rattled my saber. Like, there's good shit in it always because they're the strangest people that are allowed to make television, I think, with a decent budget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I always dig it. I dig the writing. Like, everything is very well cast, and it's always fun to see the people that they get to do the things that they have them do. Evil is a strange sort of an outlier for them in general, because they like this kind of like, not exactly ripped from the headlines like SVU shit, but they are playing in what is identifiably the world that we live in for the most part. And they're fascinated by technology and all that stuff. Evil is straight up a horror manke, like pretty deeply Catholic in its way show about like broader existential unease that's sort of shaped like a horror driven like monster of the week type thing. It is tonally one of the most confusing programs I've ever encountered. It is, I mean, again, well acted, well written, not set in a version of New York that I have ever encountered in my life. Everybody's driving everywhere and like constantly just like getting in their car in Queens and driving to Midtown or like driving to see their buddy at the church he lives in. There's a lot of weird shit in it. But I do think that, like, for me, Imperfect Kings is better than a lot of the sort of like machine tooled, but like basically what we were talking about with Shrink Next Door, that like something that is like meticulously produced at a very high level, which the King stuff reliably is, but that just kind of runs on rails, puts me off way more than a show like Evil, which I'm not 100% sure knows where it's going or what it's doing, but is 100% committed to having as strange a time possible and getting there.
I got that impression too. It seemed like they're lost in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I guess is what happens when you get these kind of like weird liminal series orders and stuff like that. Like, there's a lot of damn episodes of The Good Wife, you know, like that was like a network TV show that aired every week. Like, this is one of those, I think this season was 12 episodes. I don't even, the previous season of Evil, I think was fewer. That, like, it's a strange place to be making TV at this point. And so, like, there's definitely a chance there's not any more of it coming. I feel like, I don't know, maybe you would know better than me, but like, they're addressing questions that fascinate them in a way that no other person would address them on TV. So, like, credit where it's due. Like, I definitely enjoyed the ride, even though I wasn't sure that we weren't driving in circles the whole
right
time.
Yeah, we gotta go back to the show. People keep talking about how good it got. We watched the
it's
first
true
like,
this
three.
Is like the fourth guest who's like, so Evil.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, well, I wish I had known that.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, that's good.
It's good.
It's sort right. of like patterns emerge.
Those other persons explained it terribly.
Oh, good. Yeah. Nice. Well, as long as I defeated the other guests, I'm fine. Yeah.
All right. What do you want to plug?
Yeah. Oh, and I mean, for plugging our stuff, I mean, I'll just do the website, defector.com. Mm. I believe I've gotten to plug it on here before because I think I've been on since I quit, but I'm not 100%
sure.
Yeah,
no, you haven't.
I haven't. Wow. So, yeah, everyone that I worked with at Deadspin quit on Halloween in 2019 because there's, as far as we were concerned, the economy and the world was going to remain normal. And we had a, you know, we were having a bad time and it was just an untenable workplace. We started our own thing. It's a subscription site and it is going very well. Like, it is a real viable thing. Like, I get my health insurance through it. And
okay, brag.
We're having a good time. Yeah, sorry,
here's how,
by the way.
Here's how well they were doing. They paid for me to drink.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. With tickets. I mean, she had to exchange them herself. It wasn't a one-off. Like there were other people there too. Like, we didn't just hire Sarah to get drunk. But we could. That's how well we're doing.
You could get that for free any night of the week. You may have read in the men's room.
But yeah, there's that. And then, as mentioned earlier, the Distraction podcast that I do with Drew McGarry, and It's Christmastown, which I do with our beautiful Jeb. We love him. Jeb Lund, watching the Hallmark movies. Yep. We'll have some more of those coming. And I have to watch one that just came out that has Terry O'Quinn in it.
Oh, my.
Really, really uneasy vibe for a Hallmark movie. I'm really interested in seeing how they make that work.
Good for him.
He's probably an agent of, like, Grinch-like.
I feel like he has to be, right?
Although, but he's got that twinkly smile. He could be just a nice dad.
Just what he wants you to think, Tara. Bam! No Christmas for you.
Guys, he plays a pie. It's fine.
Yep, here's your problem. Someone set this thing to evil.
Sarah Debunting.
Oh boy, speaking of evil, The Curse of Von Dutch is a Hulu three-part docuseries. It hits, as you're listening to this, tomorrow, Thursday, November 18th. I've reviewed it at bestevidence.fyi. There will be a link in the show notes. It's very watchable at first. And then at the end of three episodes, it's like less than the sum of the parts. It definitely does a good job bringing you back to a certain time in the culture before social media, before influencer meant what it does now. But the director, Andrew Renzi, struggles a little bit on a timeline level. Like, this is true crime because of, you know, like, for reasons, one of which is a first degree murder story. But it doesn't come into play until like the third episode of three. Mm-hmm. This is the first time we even get an exact year when things are happening, never mind exact dates. And yes, you can Google to remind yourself when certain cultural signposts occurred, like Tommy Lee's Cribs episode, legend. But you should not have to do that. And as to it actually qualifying as a true crime story qua company, Curse of Von Dutch struggles to make that connection also, like several of the co-founders tangled with the law as juveniles. The brand may have been used to clean money, but we were never kind of told that. It was just sort of like gangster, as we say. And again, with this, like there are a lot of talking head interviews with various people claiming to be co-founders who I think the director kind of wanted a like interview magazine, like just let the camera run. This guy has a really sort of chewy way of talking. And it's like, well, he's not quite, it's not quite concentrated enough. So anyway, I know I'm being sort of vague because I don't want to spoil anything. It's clearly a particular shocking and tragic turn of events that the series is driving towards as the true crime hook, which just as clearly is not tied all that closely to the company and its fortunes, like the real curse of the company, which having more of this part would have made it more watchable, in my opinion, is that a handful of starfucker boneheads with no CFO aptitude let the market get oversaturated with a product that was associated with famous qua famous kudzu like Paris Hilton and Anna Nicole. Paris Hilton's intro of herself is really something. You should just skip to episode three and check that out because it is a lot. Also, she seems to have arranged not to have any pores anymore. That's good for her, I guess. I don't think it's necessarily essential viewing. It's not bad or cheesy and you will not hate it, but it's an hour too long and it gets becalmed by interviews and on the nose soundtrack cues instead of like irising out to place us more firmly in the timeline of the mid-aughts and like how we all lived then. By the end, I was ready for it to be over. And shout out to Dan Cassino. This is definitely one to watch at 1.25 speed. As I said, that review is at Best Evidence. That's at bestevidence.fyi. And I would also like to plug guest Dave, who will be appearing on the season 5 finale of Quaid in Full, in which Jeb Lund, various guests, and I contemplate Dennis Quaid's entire audiovisual career from soup to nuts, and there's a lot of nuts. The finale will be contemplating Any Given Sunday. That drops Thanksgiving Day, and you can get that wherever you get podcasts.
All right, buckle up. The holidays are coming, so I'm going to explain everything that's happening over the next, I don't know, like 2 years, it seems. Here we go.
Yep.
Word.
On EEHG, just in time for the season two finale of The Morning Show, is a extra, extra hot grade of my devising, which is there's like little scene in you blink you miss it in Billy Crudup's office where there is a promo reel about all the stuff you're going to be able to watch on UBA Plus, the streaming network in universe. So what we're doing is we freeze framed all those screens and we like put them through Photoshop for some of them and like brought down the contrast and did this and that enhance. So until we got the names of all of them. And then we're going to tell you what each and every one of those shows actually is in universe.
Yeah.
They kind of explain the show that's exact change, which is one of them. But there's like six or seven others that are just like,
oh, there's like 10.
Yeah.
I think there's 11, actually.
Absolute pervert behavior.
There's a whole bunch. So we're going to go through them one by one with our guest, Christina Tucker, who was, of course, on our morning show coverage. Also has the newsletter about the morning show. Yes. Also, her favorite thing in the universe is the morning show.
Yeah.
So we're all going to.
She has a PhD in loving the morning show.
Yes. She's a morning showologist.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Professionally.
All right. Then on the next extra, extra hot great, we have remake a miniseries, which is exactly what you think it is. Just finding something in the past, remaking it. Is Ben Franklin involved in one of them? Perhaps. Then we have important TV Barbs or Barbaras in honor of Sarah's mom. We're going to talk about Barbaras in various forms, some not nouns, that have graced our television. Then on the next extra hot great, it's let's watch a compilation of TV commercials from December 1986 during the special NBC Movie of the Week presentation of Babes in Toyland with Keanu Reeves and Drew Barrymore.
Yeah, but we didn't watch the movie. We only watched the commercials.
Yeah, we also did not visit the store.
No.
All right, now let's circle back to the EHG Primes. Next week on EHG Prime right here, it's going to be something. It's just going to be something from our vaults. I know I promised some people that in the future we were going to have fresh material, but of course, you know, we've been a little bit behind recently. So we have two we have to make up for. The first one's going to be something. The second one is actually going to be all new material. It's going to be a Thunderdome. Subject TBA. I'm going to figure out which one I want to do first.
No.
But they're both ridiculous, the
they
ones I have to choose from.
They are
completely nuts.
Deranged. Yeah.
So if you're unfamiliar with Thunderdome, it's where we bring 29 things into Thunderdome. They all have to fight three at a time, and then the winner goes on, and eventually only one person survives Thunderdome. The first one was Smurfs.
Yeah.
And then
we did Muppets.
Know, you'll see what this one is about when it comes.
I think it's 27, not 29.
Yes, thank you. And then on EHG Prime, next, it is HBO's Landscapers with guest Brandy Brown. So make sure you catch all of those 17 things. Thank you very much. That music can only mean one thing. It is time for the extra hot, great canon, an episode of TV we think is particularly worthy to be put in our version of the Hall of Fame. This week is a user submission from Lisa. Take it away, Lisa.
Hi, extra hot, great. This is Lisa from British Columbia, Canada, and I am delighted to present episode 3 from season 1 of Lodge 49, entitled Corpus, for the extra hot great canon. Lodge 49 was a hidden gem of a show that ran for 2 seasons on AMC. The entire show is a masterpiece, blending the tragic with the joyful, the hopeless with the eternally optimistic, and the realistic with the mystic. It's difficult to choose individual standout episodes, but I believe Corpus is a compelling example of everything the show does best. We begin with Dud's initiation, in a delightful ceremony that seems to both exoticize the traditions of the lodge and poke gentle fun at them. He's made an official squire of the Lynx Lodge. The next morning, his twin sister Liz teases him about his newfound passion for the lodge, but even innocuous or positive conversations are soon dominated by Liz's single-minded financial anxiety. Clip 1.
So how was it? Did they sodomize you in a dungeon?
Oh, yep. And then we had pizza. Lizard, you should come down. Okay, you can put drinks on my tab.
Yeah. So you're a squire now?
Huh? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Great. Does that come with a salary?
Oh, my God.
That's right. Brother Drag and Sister Nag together again.
I've been checking in with Tempjoy every day. Nada.
No, you've been sitting around all week reading.
Well, yeah. You know, it's an adventure of the mind.
You owe me $3,000. Don't forget that.
Okay. Love you.
Liz's preoccupation with money and her low-grade fury at Dud's lack of concern for it is one of her main storylines in season one. While Dud and Liz are working through the personal loss of their father, who went surfing a year ago and died at sea, they've both been stricken by professional and financial losses as well, and those two shades of grief converge in this episode. Liz has no room in her life or her mental space for anything but work and paying off her debt. In fact, she's even begun to have mundane dreams about work, leading to delightful interactions with her oddball coworkers, such as this. Clip 2.
I spent my entire dream at work. There was nothing weird happening. It was just like this.
Maybe you're dreaming now.
I'm working two jobs right now. I dream about both. It's a basic feature of capitalism. Yeah. You can't get loose even on weekends. You reach the Citadel, the man in the tower shoots you dead.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
You need some different colors in here, and different shapes. I'm going to send you to my apothecary.
It should be noted that when Gerson mentions different colors, he's indicating the space above her head, as though he can see her aura. More on that later. This interaction starts Liz on a cascading sequence of coincidental meetings, or are they, terminating in her old church, where the Monsignor suggests finally holding a memorial service for her father. Liz refuses, claiming that Dud isn't ready, but you can tell that a seed has been planted when he mentions the possibility of a special collection. Later, when the twins argue about money again, it turns into a full-blown, ugly fight, and we see that seed bloom into a fully developed plan. Clip 3.
I had taken a loan out to join the lodge, so. Yeah.
Wait, you took out another loan? Jesus, how many times do I have to bail you out?
No. It's not like that. See, I'm a made man at Tempjoy, so I got a steady income. I can pay you back. Eventually.
Dad, it scares me how much you're like Dad.
What?
You don't think about tomorrow. No, you're just gonna bounce along until it's too late.
Too late? Too late for what?
You know, I saw Monsignor Guzman today. He wants to do a memorial for Dad. I said no, because it would be too hard for you.
Good.
But I'm going to call him back and see if he can set up something for Saturday. Because you have to do this, Dad. It's time to say goodbye.
Okay. Let's do it. Let's do it. I feel like you're doing this just to piss me off.
I'm doing this for my own reasons. All you need to do is show up.
At this point, it seems clear that Liz's decision to hold the memorial is financially motivated. Her debt has become such a huge part of her life that it is now dictating the terms of her mourning. But Dud and Liz aren't the only ones dealing with loss. In fact, the show has created a whole community that is suffering through loss in different ways. The town's main corporate employer is shutting down, and thousands of people are losing their jobs. In fact, when Dud finally gets a work offer from his temp agency, his arrival at the nearly empty Orbis offices is not exactly celebrated. Clip 4.
Are you from Tempjoy?
No, I'm Sean Dudley. I'm supposed to talk with Gloria.
That's me. I'm head of HR. You must be one of the last people on their list. I've had 3 temps quit on me this week. I don't know why. It's the easiest job in the world. A child could do it. All you do is collate the colored sheets and put them in the folder like you see here. Do you think you can handle that?
Yep, pretty sure I can. Okay. What are these?
Termination packets.
The mountain of documents to be collated speaks volumes about the scale of these layoffs. Meanwhile, other members of the lodge are facing similar hardships. Connie is let go, or optimized out of her job, when the publication she works for decides to pivot to video. Always a winning strategy. Ernie has resorted to hilariously crashing the meeting for a new development project on the Orbis site to try to make a sales pitch and score a huge commission, which does not go well for him. Meanwhile, the Lodge's elderly sovereign protector, Larry Loomis, has checked himself out of the hospital and disappeared, leaving the entire Lodge in a state of fear and uncertainty, anxiously awaiting the arrival of an emissary from Lodge One in London who will settle all lingering questions about Larry's successor and the Lodge's future. The show and community are all greatly suffused with this sense of loss, anxiety, and loneliness. But it is in the context of all this grief and uncertainty that the true heart of the show can shine through. Dud has been portrayed as aimless and lost, and once brilliantly described as knowing less than he lets on. But this episode is the first time we really see Dud's strengths as a character. He's not just a lovable doofus who makes idiotic financial decisions and blunders about from one mishap to the next. He is generous, positive, empathetic, and has a gift for connecting with people. There is something innately valuable in what he offers other people just by being himself. Gloria, his worn-down employer, finds herself relieved of a great emotional burden after one short taste of Dud's kind and non-judgmental attitude. Clip 5.
I'm sorry if I've been a little... Everyone's pissed about their severance. It's not what they were expecting.
They get to yell at somebody. That's a gift.
We've been closing down for 5 years, building by building, department by department. People call me the Angel of Death.
No, that's not fair. You're just doing your job.
This interaction sparks a connection between the two that blooms gently throughout the episode. Notably, despite the despicable actions they may sometimes take, this show never treats its characters with anything less than compassion. Although Liz has resorted to stealing money from her own father's memorial donations, something most other shows would treat as a shocking, even unforgivable dramatic twist, this show and the viewers, having seen the scale of her financial anxiety, don't hold this against her. And seeing the arguments that she's had with Dud, could we be a little bit on her side? And Dud does, in fact, flake on his father's memorial, but it's nothing so simple as him not being ready, as Liz guesses. Instead, it's something as complex as skipping the service to do the thing that makes him feel closest to his father, pulling a dead rat out of his boss's disgusting algae-filled backyard pool. Doing this during the memorial is not an appalling decision, even as it causes Liz some hurt and disappointment. The sense of his father is more meaningful here than it is in the church. And the moment of human connection this provides is invaluable to Dud and Gloria both. The centerpiece of this episode, though, is the eulogy that Dud, after arriving eventually at his father's memorial, delivers to the crowd. It's obvious that the things he's been studying about alchemy and the mystical secrets behind the lodge have been churning around in his head with all the different types of grief he's been processing and the strange events of his recent past. His certainty that the lodge possesses some kind of answers about life and death is all tossed together with his impulsivity and lack of understanding of where exactly it's all going, leading to a eulogy that I don't think anyone in the crowd saw coming. If only I could clip the facial expressions of the crowd, the increasingly confused and mortified faces of the attendees, Liz's epic stink eye, and Blaze's incredulous, joyful grin. Alas, I cannot. Finally, this episode showcases Lodge 49's greatest strength, its incredible balancing act. This episode delves into the loneliness and loss of its characters, but contrasts that with the comfort of community, both at the Lodge and as the Dudleys' various spheres come together at the memorial. It contrasts the challenges of grief with the joy of togetherness. Endings, like death and unemployment, with beginnings, like new relationships, new jobs. It holds hopelessness and optimism in equal measure. The show takes place in a grounded reality and yet somehow makes room for the extraordinary and even the impossible to exist without feeling out of place. Was it a coincidence that Liz wandered into Blaze's shop? Or was it some mystical destiny guiding her through the lodge's sphere of influence and into emotional closure for her father? Did Dud bring a dead rat back to life somehow? Or was it living in some sort of air pocket in the filter? Is Connie seeing an aura of colors dancing above Ernie's head, the way Gerson seemed to see Liz's colors earlier, a sign of alarmingly ill health? or of transcending her limited earthly senses and seeing beyond this plane of existence. And the last moments of the episode have one final surprise in store. While the real world has featured a notable absence of body at Bill Dudley's memorial, the lodge provides. When a coincidental mishap with a Murphy bed sends Dud crashing through a wall and into a secret sealed-up library filled with books, alchemical materials, and a desiccated corpse in full lodge regalia. Though it is not, whatever you may hear later, a mummy. Every time reality begins to assert itself, when Ernie manages to talk Dud down into believing the real magic of the lodge is in singing karaoke and partying with your friends when you're feeling down, the lodge seems to inch one step ahead, carefully doling out its surprises and keeping you on your toes, wondering, is this just a weird coincidence? Are mystical forces somehow guiding Dud where he needs to go? Somehow, amazingly, the show manages to balance on that knife edge without ever letting you feel certain one way or the other, or even creating space for both options to feel simultaneously true. Apart from being exemplary, this episode is a perfect entry point to the series because it demonstrates the strengths and complexity of the show and puts you on the hook to keep watching without requiring too much knowledge of prior events to make the emotional beats accessible. For these reasons, I believe Season 1, Episode 3, Corpus, belongs in the Extra Hot Great Canon. I hope you agree.
Lisa, thank you so much. Guest Dave, you chose this from our list of submissions. Please start us off. What did you think of the episode and that submission?
To be clear up front, I agree with Lisa that this is just basically one of the best shows that's ever been on. I love it dearly. I was surprised that it was just the third episode of the show. I sort of didn't remember hitting as hard early on. It was more of like sort of a fun hang type show that I eventually realized was playing with bigger ideas in really intelligent and empathetic way. At the beginning of it, I was kind of like, you know, I wanted the show to get in because I love Lodge 49 so deeply. I wasn't sure maybe a third of the way through whether it was canon stuff or whether it was just kind of like what I remembered it being at the beginning, which was like intricate and carefully done, but like still kind of fun. I think that last leap in the back third of the show, just in terms of even before you sort of break through to the secret room, which like spoiler is like a big Lodge 49 thing. There's a lot of weird chambers and passageways and shit like that, all of which are, you know, delightful to me. I didn't remember how moving the and how carefully done the sort of the grieving aspects of it were. And I really, you know, wasn't surprised because I love the show so much, but I was caught out there not expecting to sort of feel that sort of thing again. And I did. And everything that I love about the show, which I think is like totally singular in terms of the writing and the characterization and also just the milieu of like, just happening very matter-of-factly in this context of decline and desperation and kind of shitty jobs and dignity where you can find it, all of which I think is utterly unique to this show relative to just about anything else. All that stuff that makes the series great is there. And I think as an episode, this wound up being worthy to me just in kind of that like unassuming Lodge 49-y way that it like builds towards bigger moments without ever really seeming to put a thumb on the scale in that direction. Yeah. I don't know. I thought it was great. Yeah. And so it's a yes for me, for whatever that's worth.
All right, Sarah, why don't you go next and then Dave and I will close it up.
This show I thought was going to be one where like I would enjoy the episode and I would enjoy the presentation. And then I would sort of struggle to distinguish this particular episode from other episodes in terms of like why, what sets this apart in quality. So this would have to, you know, A, do I want to keep watching? And B, does this seem utterly typical of the show? Like guest Dave, it took me until like two-thirds of the way through to be like, okay, this is everything that I remember finding extremely sort of welcoming and compelling about the show. And one of the things that I loved about this episode is all of the sort of palimpsest qualities that it has, like starting with Wyatt Russell's performance. And like, sometimes the veil is a little bit thin and you really see his parents, and then it sort of like recoheres and you're watching him again. And then that, you know, Black Mirror episode also sort of is mm-hmm. like a ticker underneath it. This character has a lot of qualities that remind me of the guy from High Maintenance, and the the look of the show and the sort of bleak, wry determination of the characters remind me of Terriers. So there's just like a lot of sort of collagey stuff that I like to this show. And it's also one of the few shows that I think actually understands how adults opposite sex siblings speak to each other ever. And like them cracking each other up with dumb crap, like the proceduralist, like it's not that funny, but they're sort of like, hey, good with that. I mean, I don't know. That spoke to me also. But most importantly, I think this show's ability to be lyrically beautiful and stupid, like in the same handful of dialogue, like that this, you know, this you googly is sort of, it, you know, it's really wonderful. And then this, what, like everyone else is cringing and this one character's like, yeah. And then it just goes off the rails with when he's like, until they burned him at the stake. No, you know, no offense, Monsignor. And the Monsignor's just like, why? I mean,
it's sort of like it's a lot about the pitfalls of modern existence. And then like Big Lebowski leaks into it like all the time, like that sort of weird otherworldly vibe. And it meshes so well.
Yeah. And it also has that sort of noir-y, I mean, all right. Since guest Dave is here and is one of the only other people who watches this fucking joint, there is that quality of like understanding that a poreless fucking 26-year-old actor is not necessarily going to be able to give you the sort of commingled weight of being in your middle age and having a lot of just plot behind you the way that Linda Emmond can. So I appreciate
Jennings
that. Yeah, yeah, I mean, everyone in the show. So this was really a delight. I was sort of like warned prior to engaging with it, like, well, yeah, so, you know, since you just lost a parent, maybe you want to ask out of this. But it's like, no, that's like, this is what it is. There's like laughing and crying also. And the show really gets at that. So why not respect it? So yeah, excellent presentation and excellent show. Can't wait to finish it. Dave and or Tara.
Great presentation. I agree. And the thing about this show, and it was funny because in season two, it was Succession on Sunday nights and then Lodge 49 on Monday nights. Like the whole season, it was like they premiered on the same on consecutive days. And so it was like the two sort of seemed like they were in, it was like a dialogue about capitalism from wildly different perspectives, where on Sunday night, it's like horrible misery of these impossibly rich people. And then on Mondays, it was like this sunny, you know, bittersweet show that was telling you, you know, money's not real in a way, but community is, as Lisa said. But the thing about the show is that it would be very easy and pat if money isn't real was the point of it, but it's not. And that's why we get the Liz character to be like, no, it's real and it fucking sucks.
Real enough.
It's like you can't just be dud. You can be dud if you have a Liz to, you know, support you, because she's the one who's actually getting shit done, as miserable as it is. I mean, waking up from a dream of just being at work is like,
oh, so fucking real.
Incredible.
Too, that like perfectly envisioned shamrocks.
Yeah.
But that being also just a totally prosaic work dream is like, I've had those, and you wake up disappointed just in your own unconscious.
Yeah. You're like,
so fucking
on in there.
Perfect. Do better. Me.
Yeah.
Where you wake up and you're like, was I even asleep or was I just thinking about something?
Yeah.
You know, you sometimes can't tell. But anyway.
I once had a dream about organizing the documents to this show. I'm not.
I believe it.
Like, what if instead of just using Google Docs, it was more structured? Yeah. And then I was wearing underwear. Yeah.
Anytime you're in the Google suite while experiencing REM sleep, like you have made a bunch of terrible decisions.
Yeah. I don't know what you call that singularity, but let us never speak of it again.
Yeah. Anyway, there's a lot of stuff that's sort of seeded here that pays off later in the season with not just Liz and her journey with Shamrocks and Shamrock's, you know, parent company, which also is, you know, a kind of money is fake story in the end, but also Ernie with the captain and his spoiler scam with this development, which is we just hear a little bit of Bruce Campbell's voice on the phone before he figures out what's happening and then very swiftly hangs up. But But of course, so you know, that what happens two-thirds of the way, and you guys have already talked about it, is that eulogy. And it's, I mean, it choked me up. Like, it's just lovely for, you know, Dud's story about, like, I didn't realize it was a great day. I didn't realize it was perfect until later, which is like, that's life. That's how it feels.
Yeah.
And, you know,
sure is.
Even when you get to the point of, like, we don't need to do all this because my dad's still here, it's like, Dud, even though he's coming at it from this, like, you know, bananas alchemy idea, it's like, that's also true. Like, that's how life also is. So this was lovely. And I agree, it was a turning point for the show, which was strong from the start, but this is really where it kicks in. So great choice and great presentation. Dave.
I think one of the reasons why the show feels like it kind of gets into gear here is they really give Liz her due when it comes to camera time and things to do in the show. She is my favorite character on the show. I thought that was a revelation, how that character rose from the background and took center stage and really became a driving force in the show. Like, her and Dud play off really well, and I love Dud a lot, but I found, like, I was constantly surprised by her character and what they were doing with her.
And shout out to Sonny Cassidy, who plays her, who is English, and you would never know. One of the best American accents by a British actor in the biz.
She played Oracle in Olympus, and it took me several episodes to get past that fact, but she did it.
She was also a robot in Humans.
She was.
Not a good role for her.
Heard of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This episode is as good as it is. It's sort of like the start of the show really ramping up. Like, this is two, maybe three layers of the seven-layer dip that this show eventually becomes. So I would say it is definitely has a place in the canon, and it is a good, it's an early episode, so I don't really would say it's a place to start necessarily. Mm-hmm. Why not watch the two episodes that start the show before it? One other note about the show, especially in these times in which we live, which is, here's a show that presents a mystery without being a fucking Reddit mystery show. And I so appreciate that in this day and age, where, like, just figuring out what's in the box or what does that secret word mean or whatever doesn't really matter. It's an entertaining ride as it happens, but it's not, like, capital T, capital P, the point. And it is the thing that draws you into the show. It is, like, the gimmick of it. It is sort of like this new element. You know, it's not quite, well, it's kind of supernatural. It's kind of insane. And it allows the show to inject a lot of levity and a lot of absurdism, which is great. And it keeps you there and it keeps you entertained. But it's not the point. Mm-hmm. Nobody cares why the polar bear is there. Just, like, get to it. So
I think that's right on. Also, it's a good argument for watching the entire show, even though it doesn't get to, you know, it didn't have the span that it deserved on TV. It didn't. Yeah. It's like the fact that it ends in this kind of, like, unresolved way, which, I mean, it's not even a spoiler, of course.
That's life.
No,
also.
Yes. But, like, it is fucking perfect. Like, it still pays off because of the fact that, like, that approach to the unknown, like, runs all the way through it coherently and consistently all the way through.
Yeah.
And I have to wonder if this show just debuted, like, 18 months later, might it still be with us, or would it have, like, gone on to a point where they could finish it? Because I feel like they missed the anything goes, please renew me streaming life in which we are now currently in, where I don't want to call it a lesser show, but lesser shows have been renewed again and again because there are 10,000 holes on our grid that we need to fill.
Yeah.
And I feel like this just missed that window where I feel like it could have got a bump from that. We maybe would have got a season or two more.
Yeah, but. And it was hard for people to find. Like, that was even pre-AMC Plus, which, you know, I'm sure some people have it. I don't. But, like, now it's on Hulu. Like, if it had been, you know, next day on Hulu the way a lot of the FX shows are, I think that really would have helped. Like, would What Would We Do in the Shadows be what it is if you couldn't stream it the next day on Hulu? Probably not. You know, sometimes these shows need a boost to get put over.
Yeah, agreed. Great presentation, Lisa. That was really good. Thank you so much. All right, let's put this to the official vote. David J. Roth, what say you? Canon worthy or not?
Yep, send it.
Sarah?
Yep, send it.
Okay, Tara?
Yep, me too. And what? There's only 20 episodes and they're all on Hulu. So, I know we say that we recommend a lot of shows on this podcast. That's what we do. But it's really special and it's really worth it.
Yeah, agreed. So let's make that 4 out of 4. Shh. That means Lodge 49, Season 1, Episode 3, Corpus, you are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for the winner and the loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
I do. Listen up, externs. Alan Toy, who you may remember as Professor Finley of the New Evolution, will now be the first polio survivor ever to play FDR in NBC's Annie Live. And we have another Annie Live winner, and that's Megan Hilty, who is replacing Jane Krakowski in Annie Live. So well done all around, I think, Annie Live.
Yeah, we and, should say.
Little comeback for Hilty after Tara nagged her recently.
Listen, so. You know, someone has to be 10th, and it's going to be the I person guess. Who's mostly voicing troll cartoons on TV. Sorry.
Mm, referring to the Smash Power rankings there.
Yes, on our last
I think we all knew it was Smash related anytime. Hilties.
Just a PS to Sarah's. That's the New Evolution, Professor Finley. That's from Beverly Hills 90210 for people who had already tapped out of the show post Brenda. That was season 5.
Yes, Kelly was in a cult.
And I guess sub loser is Jane Krakowski, who doesn't get to play this part in Annie Live because she got breakthrough COVID. Whoops. But our actual loser is Terry Crews, who for some reason decided now is the time to help Amazon by making a bunch of ads for TikTok about how great it is to work in an Amazon warehouse.
Yeah.
So here's my theory.
Uh-huh.
I know through cultural osmosis that Terry Crews is a gamer.
Uh-huh.
And having recently priced gaming computers, just so I know, not that I'm going to buy one anytime soon, but the next Mac I get isn't going to be Windows compatible, so I can't use it as two things. Right. Anyways, I know how expensive video cards are now these days, so maybe he just needs $3,000 for a high-end video card and like whatever. And if he can't read the room, so be it. That's fine. He's got his money.
Then he can start an associate's account like the rest of us. Jesus.
Yeah, way to read the room, buddy. Jeez.
It's a real Louise. Weird choice. Yeah, I finally actually saw the commercials because they were talking about them on a recent episode of Jesus and Miro, and whoo!
Yeah.
It's real embarrassing for him.
Speaking about things that could be real embarrassing for you, do you know what time it is?
Let's get that.
All right, everybody. This is the second game time of the season. The scores are Sarah with one, Tara with one, value guest still looking to get on the board. Today, we are playing Keeping It 100 from Santiago, who earns himself an extra credit topic. He writes, it's not often an actor stays on a show long enough to be in 100 episodes, and it's even rarer to hit that mark multiple times. In this game, you'll be given the name of an actor who appeared in 100 episodes of at least one show. Your job is to name as many of those shows for that actor as you can, then lock in your answer. Oh. So you will think about it. I'm not going to tell you how many they were in. It could be one. It could be 10. Once your answer is locked in, for each correct show over 100 for that actor you name, you get 1 point. For each incorrect answer you give, you lose 2.
Oh, shit.
Oh, shit.
For
negative
example,
numbers.
If you are given Ted Danson.
Oh, that's the first one I thought of.
You might guess Cheers and CSI, let's say. Then you're going to lock in your answer. Then I would tell you that you earned 1 point for correctly guessing Cheers, but you lose 2 points for CSI because it was only in 84 episodes of CSI. So you got a net score of -1. Then I might also tell you that you missed out on a point because you didn't say Becker. So if you don't name it, you don't lose 2 points. You just don't get points.
Got it. Okay.
However, the steel mills work as such. Another player can only call steel mill after the player locks in their answer, but before I reveal it. So if you said Cheers and CSI, but you know that Becker was in the mix, you say steel mill.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
Name it correctly when it's your turn, 1 point. Name it incorrectly, -2. Tara will keep track of all the points. Don't you
people
worry about that point.
Yeah. What could be simpler? Terrific. All right.
What I'm going to do is I'm just going to let everybody steal five things today. And we're not even going to, it's not going to count towards any balance sheets. Okay?
Okay.
So I'm giving you just all five today to use as you want, to steal when you want from other people, up to five times.
All right. I'm going to just make a new note to keep track of this.
Okay. While you do that, I will throw it to Picky.
We will start with David.
All right. David. Guess, David, you get to go first, and then we'll throw it to Tara, then Sarah. Only 24 questions, since there's going to be a lot of thinking and challenging and all that. Plus, you know, there's the Calvin Ball Q factor and all that kind of stuff going on. Are we ready to play Keeping It 100?
I guess. I don't. Yeah, sure.
Let's do it. You're ready.
Let's see what happens.
All right, David, your actor is Daniel Dae Kim. Think about it, and then when you're ready to lock in your answer, tell me what shows or show you think he has been in over 100 episodes of.
I'll say two, and I believe that those are Lost and Hawaii Five-0.
That is absolutely correct.
Hell yeah.
That is 2 points for Dave. Tara.
Yes.
Tyler Lee.
Okay, I'm going to guess she's done 100 episodes of, I'm fully guessing, Grey's Anatomy and Supergirl.
Also completely 100% correct.
Okay.
Sarah D. Bunting. Charlotte Ray.
Okay, Charlotte Ray did 100 episodes of Facts of Life, and then I'm sure there was something else, but I can't remember it, so I'm just going to lock it in at one, Facts of Life.
Locking in at Facts of Life with one.
Can I steal it? Oh, is that? No, if that's correct.
I'm giving her the point for Facts of Life. If you want to put in the steel mill, go ahead. It's still time.
Did she do 100 episodes of Different Strokes, too? Son of a bitch, now I have 0 points.
All right, Facts of Life is correct. Sarah gets one challenged on Different Strokes, in which she was only in 37 episodes.
Okay, so does he lose a point for
he
that?
He loses two. You always lose
2 points. Terrible. Well, now I have to get this right again. I should have never doubted.
I'm going
to
call an audible. He loses 1 point in the steel mill. I don't want you to feel really apprehensive about using the steel mill.
Okay.
So he loses 1 point.
Okay.
Good job, Sarah.
I would have said Different Strokes too. Dave.
Yep. Okay. Back to Dave. Juliana Margulies.
I'll say it's two shows, and I'll block in those as ER and The Good Wife.
Perfect.
All right.
Absolutely correct. Tara.
Yes.
Thomas Gibson.
Okay. Well, he definitely did 100 episodes of Criminal Minds. And I think that's probably it. I don't think there were that many of his other show, which I won't say in case someone else wants to steal it.
Locking in Criminal Minds for Thomas Gibson from Tara.
Yep.
1 point for Criminal Minds. No points for Dharma and Greg, 119 episodes.
Ah, see, right. I didn't think it was over 100. Okay.
Chicago Hope, only 70 episodes. Only
right.
Oh my God, that thing?
Yep.
Yeah. That thing had 70 episodes?
Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah.
Richard Dean Anderson.
Do I get the other half of the steel meal if I answer this in the correct way? Okay.
Good question.
Oh, look at her fishing. Yep. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Well, he definitely did 100 episodes of MacGyver. But what else? What else, I ask you? I think that's it. So I'm going to lock it in with just MacGyver.
Richard Dean Anderson locked in with MacGyver. 3, 2, 1. That is correct. However, you missed Stargate SG-1, his number one show with 175 versus MacGyver, 139.
That's crazy.
I knew that he was in that, and I knew that it was on for a long time because Jeb likes to talk about it on the Hallmark podcast a lot.
Does.
There's a lot of crossover between the Hallmark and Stargate SG-1 cinematic universes.
Thematically as well.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, very true. But I would never have guessed that there were 175 episodes of that
Nor
show.
Nor would I.
These are the kind of things you learn on Extra Hot Grant.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Back to Dave, LeVar Burton.
Okay.
Point of order. Are unscripted shows included?
Yes, that's okay. A good question. All right. That's helpful because the one that I know for sure that he's been in probably like 1,000 episodes of is Reading Rainbow. And then this is where my sort of incompetence as a sci-fi man really shows. Was it Star Trek The Next Generation that he was in? Those are my guesses.
Okay, so you're locking in LeVar Burton at Star Trek Next Generation and Reading Rainbow.
Yes.
You are correct on both of those.
Nice.
However, you left some points on the board.
Really?
Yes. Anybody want to take a crazy guess? The really hard ones.
Really?
Yes. 113 episodes of Captain Planet and the Planeteers.
Oh, my God.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
And
3-2-1 Contact on there?
Nope. 106 episodes of a game show.
Really?
The $10,000 Pyramid.
Good grief.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay.
All
right.
To Tara, Shawnee Smith.
Oh. Okay, well, she was in Becker, and I think that's it.
Locking in Shawnee Smith to Becker. That'll give you 1 point, but you left one on the board. Anger Management, exactly 100 episodes.
Wow.
I don't even know who that is. So
that's
there's
the Charlie Sheen show that was on FX. It was like one of their... Was not
oh, no, I remember that. I just don't... Like Shawnee Smith, I don't know who that is.
Google her. You've seen her. She was in Summer School.
Before you do that, answer this, Sarah D. Bunting. David Hasselhoff.
The Hoff. Okay. David Hasselhoff has to have been in 100 episodes of Baywatch, Mothership. But were there 100 episodes of Knight Rider is a question that I have for myself. I think there were just barely. So I'm going to say Knight Rider and Baywatch. And I think he was on a soap, but I don't remember which one. And I'm just going to hope there were only 84 episodes. I'm just leaving it at 2. Knight Rider and Baywatch.
Locking in David Hasselhoff with Knight Rider and Baywatch.
Mm-hmm.
You are both correct.
Yay.
But also incorrect. Baywatch, 209 episodes. Knight Rider, 86 episodes.
What?
So you're one down, -1 on your answer set there.
Okay.
Baywatch Nights, 45 episodes, which is really the superior Baywatch as far as I'm concerned, never having watched one.
Okay, right. So because I got Baywatch, that was a point.
And you lost 2 on Knight Rider.
God.
So you're down 1 on that set.
But Michael. Okay.
Kate Mulgrew for Dave.
Kate Mulgrew.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't expect that one. So she... Why do I keep getting the fucking Star Trek questions, man?
Gotta learn sometime.
I think that I know. Well, this is how it goes. It's not always going to be sort of a
maybe zipless, you could turn
painless process
defector into deflector, and it's all that Star Trek.
Stuff. I'm working on it. If I'd gotten the Hasselhoff thing, I would have had my coworker Dan McQuaid has rewatched the entire Hasselhoff corpus.
Wow, recently,
including he has a wife too. They just sit there and watch Knight Rider together. They're very happy. I mean, as far as I can tell. But all right, so for Kate Mulgrew,
this is some excellent stalling, by the way.
Yeah,
McQueen in full. Well done.
I'm just gonna pull the trigger on this. So I'll take. I'm gonna say that she was in 100 episodes of Orange Is the New Black. I feel like there's been 100 episodes of that, probably. Although I don't. Well. She's been in all of them. It's been on way longer than I have paid attention to it. So I will say that and Star Trek Voyager.
All right. Locking in Kate Mulgrew, Star Trek Voyager, and Orange Is the New Black. But.
son of a bitch.
Star Trek Voyager, 168 episodes. Orange Is the New Black, 91 episodes.
Oh.
It's the last time I trust my instincts.
Anybody want to name the other show? 421 episodes.
Oh, my God. What? She was on a soap?
Yeah.
Oh.
Ryan's Hope. 421 episodes. Okay. Tara.
Yeah.
Allison Hannigan.
Okay. There definitely were 100 episodes of Buffy, and there definitely were 100 episodes of How I Met Your Mother, so those are my answers.
Locking in Allison Hannigan for How I Met Your Mother and Buffy. Perfect. Exactly correct. 2 points. Sarah, take us into our score break halfway through. Dick Van Dyke. Friend to Dolphins. Dick Van Dyke.
I feel like those old sitcoms had like 67 episodes a season.
Yeah, I feel like they did too. So,
Or is Tara just saying that to lead you on?
No. Don't go by me. I'm just musing.
If it's in black and white, Tara.
Look down this really dark, deep pit, Sarah.
I really don't need the help. I can lose just fine all by myself, as you know. I'm going to say the Dick Van Dyke Show, and that's it. Locking in.
All right, locking in Dick Van Dyke for the Dick Van Dyke Show. You are...
Steel Meal. I'm going to also say...
Correct.
Okay. So she gets one. And I think he also did 100 episodes of Diagnosis Murder.
That is correct. Yes. So you both get a point there.
Woo.
I also thought that. Do I get a point for that?
Did you say you steal meal, Dave?
No, I was afraid, David. I was afraid to say it.
Look, I had that idea years before somebody made it into a product. I deserve at least 3%. That's the fantasy you're living right now. All right, score break, please. Tara,
oh my God.
Give you a moment.
This game is very frustrating math-wise, but Sarah has 2 points, I think. Dave has four
I
points.
I think so.
And I have 7 points.
Let's get back into it. Don't Dave, you. Kim... Fields. Kim Fields.
Oh, okay. So it's great that there's been so much Facts of Life chat on this. Not as much Becker chat, kind of a lot more Becker than I expected. So I'm going to say Kim Fields definitely did 100 episodes of Facts of Life. And I believe that she did 100 episodes of Living Single. That feels like a show that was on for a really long time. So those are my two.
Locking in Kim Fields, Facts of Life, and Living Single. Perfect. 2 points.
Yay.
Nicely done.
All right.
Yeah.
Katie Sagal.
Oh, cripes. Okay. Well, shit. She's definitely done 100 episodes of Futurama. There probably were 100 episodes of Married with Children. And I'm not confident about how many episodes there were of Sons of Anarchy. So I'm just going to lock in with those two.
Katie Sagal locking into Futurama and Married with Children.
Yep.
2 points. Sons of Anarchy, 92 episodes. Mm. Good call there. Eight Simple Rules,
very
76 episodes. Yes. All right. Sarah. Kelsey Grammer.
Hmm.
I should know. I'm Frasier.
Frasier. I don't think there were enough episodes of that Boss show. The question is, was he on enough Cheers?
Boss!
You're welcome for that.
Low-key, Boss was a really enjoyable show.
It really was.
I remember you saying that. Yeah. I remember you saying that.
That had like Kathleen Robertson. Yep.
Yeah.
Right? Longtime wife of mine, Kathleen Robertson. We love her.
Yeah. Oops, my underwear. That's her role in the show. A lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was great.
Mm-hmm.
Murder in the First also. Not that anyone cares about that show anymore.
I watched that shit.
Pretty good.
Wow, she really was your wife.
I think it's just Frasier. I think he didn't cross the Cheers Rubicon of 100. So locking in with just that one.
All right, locking in Kelsey Grammer to Frasier. That is correct. But you left Cheers on the board. 263 episodes of Frasier.
Really?
He was on 202 episodes of Cheers.
Good grief.
Wow.
I never would have guessed that. He came
Me
on
either.
Early. I guess.
He was always there.
I just thought he left earlier than he did, so that's why.
Oh, no. He was there until the end.
Right. Anybody want to guess how many episodes of The Simpsons he's been on?
Oh, like probably 30?
Close, yeah. 22. Yep. Want to guess what animated show he's had more appearances on than The Simpsons?
Family Guy.
Trollhunters, Tales of Arcadia. All right, back to Dave. Jane Leaves.
Jane Leaves. I'm probably leaving points on the board, but the only one I know is Frasier, so I'll just say Frasier.
Locking in Jane Leaves to Frasier. You
steel
get
meal.
A
Why the hell?
Point, yeah, but there's a steel mill in play.
Okay. Hot in Cleveland?
Hot in Cleveland is also correct. Yes.
How many episodes of that show existed?
She was also in 263 episodes of Frasier, and she, I don't know, she is friends with Frasier. And Hot in Cleveland, 125 episodes.
God damn.
Why That's is off. That? Why does that exist?
All right. Tara.
Yeah.
Sherman Hemsley.
Okay. The Jeffersons. Amen. End of list. I'm just going to say those two.
You're locking in to Jeffersons and Amen.
Yeah.
Perfect. 2 points. Yes. Sarah, Tara's favorite, Betty White.
Betty White. Okay.
Well, you just got a nice hint on this one.
Yes, yeah. I sure did.
Show that everyone forgot until 30 seconds ago.
Seriously. Still limping on. So, Golden Girls and Hot in Cleveland.
So mad even saying the name.
Cleveland. Cleveland. We had to watch it for again with this once, and I was like, oh, right, that's why.
Guess what? There's another one that Luke Perry's in, so it may come up again.
I know. Sigh. There's more, but I can't pull it, and I don't want to say she was on 100 Match Games because you don't want to say that about anybody. So I'm going to stop at 2, Hot in Cleveland and Golden Girls.
All right, locked in Betty White, Hot in Cleveland and the Golden Girls. 2 points, Hot in Cleveland and the Golden Girls. Closest, but under 100, the Mary Tyler Moore Show at only 45. Yeah.
Oh, it was that few? I thought it was like 70.
It did seem like it should be more, yeah. All right, back to Dave. Sam Waterston.
What about him? Terrific. We love him. All right, so...
Honestly, Sam Waterston's greatest contribution to pop culture is the robot insurance commercial from Saturday Night Live.
We all agree.
Okay, good.
So, I got him for Law & Order, that's for sure. I feel like there's many other things that he's done. I don't know how many episodes are in a season of Grace and Frankie, but it feels like it can't possibly be enough. Yeah, like if there weren't enough episodes of Orange is the New Black to get Kate Mulgrew over the line, then there sure aren't enough episodes of Grace and Frankie to get Sam Waterston over. Again, like I know that I'm probably leaving shit on the board. Like he was in some 80s show that I don't remember. I'm just going to leave it there and take my point and let somebody steal whatever else they need to steal.
All right, locking into Law and Order. You are perfect. Exactly one show over 100, and that was it. Now, Grace and Frankie, only 83 episodes. Extra point opportunity for everybody involved. Closest to the pin, how many episodes of Law and Order was he on?
Oh, my God.
I can't compete in this contest against Sarah D. Bunting. It's ridiculous.
170.
That feels high.
Shout it out whenever you want. I'm not going in order. Right.
I'm going to say 225.
Because he was the big boss for a while, too. And now I can't remember how many seasons that was.
200 even.
David J. Roth takes the extra point. Oh, the boy nobody loved just won the TV Super Bowl.
That's me.
368 episodes.
Wow.
Yes.
Jeez.
Get those checks, Sam.
That's
damn.
Incredible. I could be closest and be wrong by like 50%. That's amazing. Good for him. That guy definitely has a vacation house. You know he can afford a vacation house.
All right, Tara, back to you.
Okay.
Jesse Spencer.
Okay. He probably did 100 houses.
Homes.
Probably did 100 homes. And he probably did 100... Oh, fuck, which Chicago show is he on? I'm going to say House in Chicago Fire.
Is that your lock-in?
Yes.
Jesse Spencer locked into Chicago Fire and Hoos. You have just gained yourself 2 points.
Nice.
You left something on the board, though.
Really?
Yes. 461 episodes.
Oh, he was on a soap? Was he on like Neighbors or something?
He was on Neighbors indeed. That is correct.
Yes. Nice. He's Australian.
All right. To Sarah D. Bunting. Jason George. That's two first names, one person.
Sarah's favorite, a man with two first names.
Jason
Can't
George.
Trust him.
It's like George Costanza and Jason Alexander merged into one person. His name is Jason
literally...
George.
Don't know who Jason George is.
Well, this
so I'm
is going to be
Benson
fun for you.
And lock it in.
What? I'm sorry. What was it?
I'm guessing Benson and locking it in.
Locking it in.
Fuck Benson. This!
Okay, here's the deal. That is incorrect. No. But I'm giving you an extra steel meal for your troubles.
Thank you.
All right. Anybody? No? Okay. Jason George.
He's from Grey's, right?
Grey's Anatomy, 139 episodes. Mm. 352 episodes of Sunset Beach.
Sure.
Incorrect. Yeah. Would be Station 19 at only 63 and Eve at 66. Woo! All right, everybody's last question coming at you, so let's get them current scores, please, Tara.
Oh, God.
Okay, well, Sarah locked in with Benson and lost 2 points, so now Sarah has 3 points, Dave has 9 points, I have 14 points.
Okay.
I'm just glad I have any points, Jason. Well, this, George. I
read years ago about the basketball player Mike Miller had a shooting drill that he would do that was the same scoring as this, but it was for three-pointers. If you made one, you get a point. If you missed, you lost two. And I was like feeling myself, and I used to shoot around a lot often then, and I was like, I'm going to do this. And I shot for like an hour and finished with like negative 26. Like, this is, it's a difficult feeling. You shouldn't have to lose points on things just for being wrong.
We just want you to have a nervous and bad time here. That's all. Okay. See if you get this. Kim Raver.
Yes. This is one of those names that I'm, like, faintly aware of, and I'm sure that if it were permitted for me to go bother my wife in the other room where she's working.
She can tell you who she was,
Dave, don't forget, you have the one thingy, as we've been calling it, where you can give this question to somebody else and get their question.
Oh.
Did you say that?
Yes.
What?
You just didn't hear it.
I didn't. Okay. I for sure didn't hear that, although there were a lot of instructions, so I might have checked that out. Yeah, because I don't really know anything. Well, actually, you know what? I'll guess one, because I'm pretty sure that Kim Raver did 100 episodes of Grey's Anatomy.
All right, he's putting the thingy back in his pocket.
I'm putting the, yes, it's as not a visual medium, but all the people on this call certainly are aware of that. Let's see Grey's Anatomy. Was she in 100 episodes of that?
Kim Raver locked in Grey's Anatomy. You are 1 point richer, my friend.
Good.
You left one on the board. Anybody want to guess what that one is?
Was it, this is not for a steal, but was she, did they have 100 episodes of Third Watch?
Yes, they did. 111. Wow. Not making the cut, 53 episodes of 24.
Sure.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Sure. I knew that she was on a popular long-running show that I didn't watch. Mm-hmm. And then Grey's Anatomy is just on in the house enough that I knew she was on.
I mean, but I don't know how popular Third Watch was, but it was on for a long time.
Yeah. Motorcycle
and the Lobby Show. I watched that and not Grey's, so.
Tara.
Yes.
Mila Kunis.
Ooh, okay. Two. That 70s show. And Family Guy.
2 points. Perfect. Well done. Ending off with Sarah D. Bunting. You have a thingy too. I don't know why you didn't hear it. So if you want to, I can substitute another question for Seth MacFarlane.
Oh.
Yes, I would like another question.
You would like another question.
All fucking right. A.
Seems like that would be easy, but okay. Doop, boop, 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 boop. Hang on. Wait a sec. Hang on. All right. Sarah D. Bunting, here you go. Okay. Your question is...
Robert Guillaume.
Nope. Your question is... Daniel Day Kim.
I did that one. That was
I know
me.
You did. The game's over. Who cares? Daniel Day Kim and Seth MacFarlane.
Oh, shit! Double point opportunity.
Yeah. Run up the score.
American lost 5-0.
Wait, American
Dad?
Lost
5-0.
Locked in?
Yes.
Did you say Dad at the end too?
Three points. Left one on the board. Big one.
The Orville, of course.
The Orville, of course. No. So I think you had American Dad in there.
Yes.
You had lost and you had Hawaii 5-0.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't hear a Family Guy in there.
Right.
No, I should have
and
said American
That was
guy.
The only one you missed. Cleveland Show, 65. Robot Chicken, 26. The Orville, 37. So well answered for 3 points there. Let's hear the final scores done.
Well, everyone did their best.
Was here.
And it was a fun game. Sarah finished with 6. Dave had 10. And I had 16.
All right, well done. Now, at this point, I will say that this game was split into two because I knew it was going to go long with everybody thinking and stealing.
Smart.
So we have part two of Keeping 100 coming sometime in the future. So prepare yourself for that eventuality.
All right.
But today belongs to Tara.
Yay.
Tara.
Tara.
Tara. Thank you very much, Santiago. That was fun.
Yes.
All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We sat on the couch for The Shrink Next Door before going around the dial with stops at Yellow Jackets, Saturday Night Live, Evil, and The Curse of Von Dutch. Lisa's initiation into the secret society of the EHG canon was successful, and in celebration of Lodge 49 getting in, we're having ribs. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time. Up next, it's programming on UBA Plus on Extra Extra Hot Great, and the next EHG Prime, well, you'll just have to wait and see. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David Teagle, and on behalf of Tara Ariano.
I had something and I forgot.
All right, hang on a second. What were the final scores in Game Time? Because I think I might have to deduct some points.
6, 10, and 16.
Oh, okay, that's too many. All right.
Yeah.
Sarity Bundy.
The proceduralist.
And so far you've all lost 2 points. And David J. Ross.
Is that Reggie Jackson?
I ascended my apothecary.
Plus
that's
2 points.
It was.
Plus 2 points. The official scores, -2 for Tara on the total, -2 for Sarah, +2 for David Roth. Thank you very much, everybody.
I won.
And Diane's husband passed away. The insurance company said his policy didn't cover them.
They had no money to pay for the funeral. It's so hard nowadays with all the gangs and rap music.
What about robots?
Oh, they're everywhere.
I don't even know why the scientists make them.
Darren and I have a policy with Old Glory Insurance that covers us in case we're attacked by robots.
An insurance policy with a robot plan?
Mm-hmm.
Well, certainly I'm too old.
Old Glory covers anyone over the age of 50 against robot attack, regardless of current health.
I'm Sam Waterston of the popular TV series Law & Order. As a senior citizen, you're probably aware of the threat robots pose. Robots are everywhere, and they eat old people's medicine for fuel. Well, now there's a company that offers coverage against the unfortunate event of a robot attack, Old Glory Insurance. Old Glory will cover you with no health checkup or age consideration. You need to feel safe. And that's harder and harder to do nowadays because robots may strike at any time. And when they grab you with those metal claws, you can't break free because they're made of metal and robots are strong. Now, for only $4 a month, you can achieve peace of mind in a world full of crime and robots with Old Glory Insurance.
Robots, they're coming! Robots!
Oh, it's a friendly robot. This time.
So don't cower under your Afghan any longer. Make a choice. Old Glory Insurance. For when the metal ones decide to come for you. And they will.